Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Counsel Incorporated. Her websites, jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jim.
Danielle, central banks, they're not raising rates, but they're not lowering them. Is this trend going to continue?
Well, according to them, yes. If you listen to the latest Bank of Canada release yesterday, Tiff Macklem's press conference, whether it was Chairman Powell and the Fed on Capitol Hill yesterday and his testimony, the UK central bank just kept their rates at the same level. So everyone's sitting tight, as I like to say, at the highest rate since 2007. You know, they haven't raised since July. But the reality is they're between a rock and a hard place, and the reason is primarily housing. So all those years of very lax lending standards and low interest rates fueled a massive housing bubble and lots of speculation globally, and capital flows moved all over. It was all kind of interconnected. And of course, then prices got unaffordable in pretty much a whole bunch of places at the same time, never more than in Canada, of course. And then they tightened rates by the most since the Volcker cycle in the early 1980s, you know, in a rapid period of rise from very, very low base rates, which meant there was a massive increase in the cost of carry. And that has shocked the system. And now we're having, you know, they're looking at the fact that the cost of housing or shelter makes up about a third of the CPI basket, the Consumer Price Index, which they are mandated to try and keep around this target of 2%, which was sort of picked out of the air a number of years ago. So they're supposed to, that's their mandate, keep the CPI appreciating about 2% a year, not a lot less and not more, around 2%. Of course, with all the fiscal handouts that happened during the pandemic, on top of all the ultra-low interest rates, they had this surge in inflation, and now they are stuck with too high. Most of the components in the basket are coming down in terms of the amount of inflation. Their disinflation doesn't mean the prices are absolutely falling, but they're appreciating at below target rates. So they're back within the range. The problem is this third that's the housing bucket. And that is going to be a problem, because even if they're sitting tight and they're looking at the spring, you know, spring came real early to North America. As you know, Jim, the weather's been incredibly warm for winter. Every year, of course, it's warmer than the one before. And what that means is that the so-called spring market for housing, which everyone's been holding their breath thinking, you know, in the spring they'll list and there'll be a lot more appetite. They were assuming rates would be lower by the spring. Well, that's not materializing, because central banks are looking at this overinflated housing sector and saying, goodness, if we start cutting rates, we're only going to make that worse, because, you know, we risk reigniting a frenzy of people trying to borrow and buy into these really high prices, and that will inflate the cost of shelter even more, and that means the CPI is going to stay above target. So, you know, they're looking at kind of a train wreck happening in many parts of the economy, and they're thinking, you know, this is not going great. The World Bank came out with its outlook for 2024 this week, and it's projecting now growth in 2024, this year, for the third consecutive year, slower growth, and at a rate of about 2.4% from about 2.6 last year. And all of this, you know, traditionally a growth rate globally of about 3% for GDP was always considered the stall speed, and anything under that was recessionary. And now we've got, you know, this outlook for 24 that's less than 3%. And it's largely a function of too much debt, too much strain in the household sector, which is, you know, the driver of most of the world economy, certainly in the developed world. And the fact that the cost of carry on this debt has increased 30%, and we can tell that fixed-term debt is going to continue to come up for renewal. So, you know, some 20% in 2024 and another more than that in 25. And these were all debts that were taken out when mortgages were less than 2% or interest rates were very, very low. And so even if they don't cut rates, even if they, you know, stay here and never hike further, you're going to get this tightening in the financial sector that impacts households, which means they're pulling back spending on everything else in the economy. And if they do cut rates in a panic because things are starting to go off the rails, then they risk this kind of resurgence of manic behavior in housing, meaning more people desperately trying to buy, and that'll just defeat the whole purpose again. So it is really, as I say, a rock in a hard place, and I think that right now they're just watching, sort of holding their breath, thinking, okay, well, we better not cut, we better just wait. And meanwhile, you know, the labor market's deteriorating, businesses are cutting their work week, they've cut it already by the most that typically what the amount they do during recessions, you know, the amount of jobs available for people has come down significantly. So that's their other mandate, right? Especially in the United States, their other mandate is trying to keep this full employment idea. But full employment, you know, right now the official unemployment rate is less than 4% in America. It's risen in Canada already, you know, 5.9%. It's already risen more than 0.5%. And traditionally when you get that increase of 0.5% in the unemployment rate, you're already in a recession typically. So that's called the SOM rule. It's typically from the United States, was developed by an American economist. But, you know, the labor market continues to deteriorate here. And so that's the other piece of concern, right? At some point, keeping rates tight, sitting tight for longer out of fear of reigniting, you know, an asset frenzy in housing, means that you're seeing the unemployment rate tick up. You're seeing layoffs mount. You're seeing that's not going to help, obviously, a stressed out consumer sector where not just household prices have gone up, but rents, of course, nationally in Canada are up 8% year over year. And that's a function, again, of, you know, wherever landlords can, they're evicting people and trying to re-rent the place at a higher rent to cope with their higher costs. And when people are moving, that is showing that when it gets re-rented onto the market, it's like 24% higher, 30% higher, depending on the city. So again, back to strain spreading in households. Housing is a big problem because of the weight of how much that takes of household income. It's a big problem for getting inflation back to target because of the 30% weight that it makes up of the basket. And at the same time, as unemployment rises, you know, more people are defaulting on debts. We've got a big default wave going on in delinquencies. So, you know, this is not just mortgage debt, but regular kinds of debt are leaping, you know, 30% nationally. And in the most populated provinces, Ontario and BC, Jim, as you know, that's where people, you know, the housing costs got the most obscene in those places, and the commensurate debt that people took on to buy into these housing markets was the highest. That's where incomes are the highest, so they can borrow the most. Well, now we're seeing the latest Equifax data showed that mortgage delinquencies, so this is payments that are 90 days or more late, were up 52% year over year in the final quarter of 23. They were up 135% in Ontario and 62% in BC. And here's the kicker, both above pre-pandemic levels for those cities. So we're now, you know, that all that money that was handed out by governments during the pandemic, you know, the deferral periods, the kicking the can down the road, telling consumers, don't worry if you can't make your payments. All that's kind of coming home to roost. It delayed this whole process, but now people are admitting they're insolvent, going to see trustees in bankruptcy, and the insolvency filings are up extraordinarily as well, 23% nationally, more than 30% in Ontario. So this is a gangbuster business for the trustees in bankruptcy, but the bottom line is people are reorganizing, realizing, crying uncle, saying I can't make my payments now. And lenders are setting aside, of course, you know, big loan loss provisions. We saw that in the latest bank earnings data. I think there's more of that to come, because under the hood, when you look at the banks in Canada, three of the big five still have, you know, 13 to 15% of their mortgage book in these negatively amortizing loans, which is crazy. They should never have even got there. You know, this is horrible management. They should never have decided to let people make payments less than their interest costs and to just keep adding that, you know, compounding negatively and adding it to the debt balance, because that's what's happened. So the amount of, you know, as consumers pull back, they're not spending on all these discretionary items, and you're getting a whole bunch of companies warning that they're missing their guidance and forward-looking, you know, like Foot Locker missed yesterday. That's in the, obviously in the retail sector, and the share, you know, dropped 29%, looking at forward outlook being bad. And business insolvencies are up, you know, 40%. Year over year in January. That's the highest Canadian business insolvency level filing since 2006. So we're talking about worse than in 2008 already being reflected in Canada. And, you know, four of G7 economies were already in recession in the final quarter of 23, Japan, the UK, France, and Germany. Germany this morning, the factory orders out of there were down 11% month over month. That's more, almost twice what the consensus was thinking. So all of this to say, it's very interconnected, and housing is the largest asset, and it's also, real estate is the most levered asset in the world. So it was the, you know, the thing that got the most garishly inflated during the low rate, speculative time, and it's the thing that's causing the biggest headache for economies, employment, households, and central banks now in this period.
What does China's economic slowdown mean for Canada?
Well, so there we're interconnected on many levels as well. You have the obvious, which is the export market. You know, while we were all borrowing and spending our brains out over here, China was, of course, the manufacturing go-to spot for the last decade. And they were the benefactor of our proliferate spending, where we were demanding a lot of goods and they were sort of piling, you know, savings up while we were spending too much. Now, coming out of the Great Recession, China was then able to deploy a lot of those reserves that they had built up while we were spending like crazy people, and they then turned around and tried to stimulate their economy by building out the realty sector. So developing, they built all these mansion subdivisions that no one there could afford. Like based on household income, it was obscene. It was ridiculous. Nobody could actually live in these things, but they were offering it to the people as a way to get wealth, right? Was to say, like, their stock market had crashed from the peak in 2006-07, and people lost their shirts, so they diverted the proletariat to the idea of, here, you can make back your money by speculating in real estate, and we'll make loans readily available, and developers got lots of cheap credit, and they built out all this capacity all over the country for housing that no one could actually afford to live in based on their household income. So you see a theme here similar to what I was talking about in places like the West and places like Canada, where housing's been, you know, 10 to 20 times household earnings. It just, like, off the charts crazy. But in China, the household income levels were even much lower. And so a lot of speculation. So that drove huge demand for exports from countries like Australia, New Zealand, you know, Russia, Canada to some extent. Our commodities producers really benefited from that boom in debt-financed development in China. The other way that we were influenced, of course, was the flow of capital that came out of places like China that was looking to diversify away from the communist state, right, to other countries and other asset types. And they flowed into places like Toronto and Vancouver. And this is all very well documented. You've heard of this before many times, I know, Jim. And then we had this whole cycle. This is the Sam Cooper work that shows about the willful blindness that went on of capital flows coming in from places like China into the money laundering through the casinos, you know, into the fentanyl trade, and then hiding money in the real estate market, which helped to inflate prices there, make the bubble even worse. And now in this period, we're having everything reverse again. So in China, in spades, right? So the property developers started going bust there a couple of years ago. That spread, and housing prices have been dropping month over month over month. There's now, you know, they're doing all sorts of postings online, you can see, of people filming these empty subdivisions and buildings and towers with nobody in them. And people are not interested in buying them now that the prices are all coming down, and they realize they've been, you know, duped or had. They've lost their shirt again. This is like the second big asset sort of scam that they've, you know, been involved in now in the past, 15 years, so to speak. So basically, all that means that there's capital flows are trying to reverse back out of places like Canada now to some extent. Some people are finding cash crunch at home, right? They're needing to repatriate funds. So that's a headwind again for countries that benefited from those flows in the first place. At the same time, you've got the Chinese economy. The government is not willing to spend and borrow and, you know, put in as much debt finance capital as they did after the Great Recession. So they're saying, you know, housing's not a property for, housing's not a means for speculation. It should be for living in. Well, this is a whole new theme, and they're letting, so far, they're seemingly letting the mean reversion process happen. So that has an impact for global demand, not just on the goods side, but in terms of manufacturing and in terms of capital flows. So it has a wide impact. And of course, they have a terrible demographic problem there as well. Terrible. Most of the developed countries have way less births than they do to replace their population. And if you look at that trend out to 2100, a lot of the population in some of these countries will be less than half of what it is today. So ultimately, that presents a larger challenge. I mean, on the one hand, I think, thank goodness for the planet. This will be good that there's less humans and we're going to, you know, get into a downshift in our population. But on the other hand, for an economy that's dependent upon people borrowing and spending continually more and more each year, this is going to be obviously a game changer. When you have so much less young population to come along and buy things like assets off the older generations, but also when you've got the baby boomers' capital flows reversing because they're spending down their savings, they're starting to take withdrawals out of investment markets. We're at the point now where the baby boomer flow is actually going the opposite way. And so the question is, how much younger people and younger workers do you have putting flows into these asset markets to buy them off of and sustain prices? And that's where we have another tricky bit to this equation yet to come.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, how big a problem is money laundering in Canada? In BC, we had an inquiry, but the premier refuses to enact the number one recommendation from the inquiry, and that was to develop a department with a commissioner to go after money laundering. Are they so dependent on this money they're addicted to it?
It seems like that's the case. Sam Cooper's work in this area is very detailed. There's a lot of insiders, whistleblowers, people both within financial institutions, like the HSBC story that broke, that he broke in the last little while, just about the fake income filings that were coming from places like China, where people were able to borrow millions of dollars to funnel into real estate in Canada with no proof of income. So this is the liar's loan theme from the 2006 bubble in the United States that's really played out hugely and on a larger scale in some cases in Canada, where, you know, this is easy stuff to fix. We just have to have income verification requirements and not let people skate around the rules, which were put in place obviously for extremely important and obvious fundamental reasons. But you have a bunch of people, evidently, not just inside financial institutions, but inside governments, who have been the benefactor of basically bribes. Like, what else do you call it when these entities are flowing capital into the coffers of these politicians and representatives and regulators? And, you know, that everyone loves the optics of it on the way up. It looks like, you know, that you're getting on this build out of all these properties and gentrification of everything. And, you know, Canada got to something like 70% home ownership stats of citizens. And it all looked rosy on the way up. The problem is that now, as I say, it's got so untenable for the average household and young people, and no one can afford to buy these inflated properties in terms of the domestic economy and people that are actually resident here with actual incomes, like not reporting fraudulent or money laundered capital flows from somewhere else, but households that are actually working in the economy, they're having a difficult time just trying to keep shelter over their heads. And this is where you get the unraveling then. So it's in the best interest longer term to allow prices to come down and to ferret out this corruption and the illegal flows. You know, we shouldn't have a bunch of casinos operating. You know, I remember a time, Jim, in the late 90s when casinos were illegal, and it was this slippery slope of gambling that was, you know, came in, and then it spread to a major revenue generator for governments. Well, now you've got politicians looking how to keep boosting that income generation, which means money laundering, and the criminals and the triads and all the people that are putting money through that system are somehow now bringing revenue to the governments, and they see this as a positive thing. When it's, you know, it's basically depending on all the wrong engines. It's a very counterproductive, destructive place to get the revenue from in the first place, but in the short run, it looks like it's prosperous and doing well, right? So, yeah, the it's not a question of evidence anymore. It's a question of will and insistence from the public, and it's you know, unfortunately, I would say this is a theme all over the world where basically people think that, you know, corruption is so prevalent and bad guys keep getting away with everything and making off like bandits, or, you know, paying fines and getting out of jail free and all this stuff. And it really has this whole flavor now of, you know, well, why not? Everyone else is doing it. Well, the reasons why not are classic and old as time, and they, you know, basically come to a point where the whole thing breaks down, and there's an uprising usually of people demanding that the people that have been on the take be thrown out, and, you know, you kind of restart the cycle all over again. So it's a lot, and it's coming to a head, and who knows what we're going to actually do to correct the system. But I think that once unemployment continues to spike, once people realize they've been sold a bill of goods, this is kind of like what's happening in China right now. Once the people realize that asset bubbles have burst and that they actually didn't get wealthy, they ended up with a bunch of debt and negative equity, then they're not as tolerant of the current system, and they tend to then, you know, take to the streets and demand heads and demand change. So we're going to find out, you know, as this cycle proceeds. Right now, you've still got we're back to day traders in the stock market, thinking they're making off like bandits, and you've got this uber bullish bent, you know, again, like 50, almost 60% of investment news are bullish today. We're at extremes we haven't seen since 2021. Back when interest rates, Jim, were 0.25 as far as the overnight rate goes. So now that we're at 5%, we've got stock markets and some, a handful of things back to the same level as when money was priced at nothing. So something's going to give here, and we're going to find out soon how it all falls out.
Yeah, on the money laundering. Now, if you had a money laundering commission and civil forfeiture, it would more than pay for itself. Governments are looking for new sources of revenue. Why not go after the illegal money makers?
Well, there is no reason not to, other than the status quo is wanting to keep it the way it is. You know, like, it's indefensible, clearly, and we need to have some actual will to do it, to take the hit in the short run, to let the chips fall, you know, and then ultimately you can rebuild a much better, stronger system. That's been shown so many times throughout history, but it's just that it's a painful process in the short run. And, you know, but that's why I say once bubbles burst and the perception of prosperity or the perception of progress evaporates, that's typically when people start looking for, you know, new ways to do things.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.